Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Defense Department has been trying to get a clear sense from the White House about what it wants and does not want in the Overseas Contingency Operations Budget, or OCO. But the last administration's budget office left those decisions for the new administration. So now what? For more, we turn to John Pendleton, Director of Defense Capabilities at the Government Accountability Office. John, good to have you on.
Good morning, Tom.
The OCO has been politically contentious, but it's also a lot of practical decisions, I guess, that DOD has to make about what should be in it, what should not be in it. And so what did your report find, and what made you look at this now anyway?
We've actually been looking at the use of OCO. It's commonly called OCO in today's terms. It used to be called Global War on Terror Funds, or GWAT. For more than a decade, GAO has been tracking the use of it and been warning about the temptation and and raising concerns about the blending of the war funding, which was originally intended to cover incremental costs associated with going to war, fuel, ammunition, contractors, so the services didn't have to fund it out of hide, and raising concern that it's getting more and more difficult to disaggregate what is a war cost versus what would be a long-term cost, even if we didn't have wars going on.
I guess it's fair to say that at some point, war costs that are direct do back up into what might be earlier considered operational or base budget types of costs.
I think that's fair. It gets difficult to separate it out. I mean, if peace were to break out tomorrow, and I hope it will, and we brought folks home from places overseas, even places where bullets are flying, like Afghanistan, you would still need bases in that region. And even bases that are outside Afghanistan around the region are primarily being funded with OCO funds. So even if the war was to end, we would still need money to cover those bases, because I don't think anyone thinks we're going to close many of them anytime soon.
Now, a big argument has been, you know, between, I guess, or among members of Congress and White Houses and the Defense Department itself, there's always been a suspicion that defense is putting base budget type things into the OCO because of sequestration and the budget caps that have been in place. And what's the reality of the dynamic there?
I think it's pretty much an open secret at this point that OCO is being used to cover base costs. Some of the costs are actually even labeled non-war. If you break down the budget request for the current fiscal year, about 70% of it was, or $45.1 billion, was for Afghanistan, another $10 billion or so to support and equip and train and such in Iraq and Syria. And then there was over about $5 billion to actually support base requirements that's identified right in the request. And then another $3.4 billion to support the European Reassurance Initiative, initiative to reassure allies and frankly, deter Russia. And then there's another billion to cover counterterrorism. So it's a real mixed bag, but probably $30 billion or so of the overall $65 billion, although there's not a precise estimate, we'd need, even if the activities that we have ongoing in Afghanistan and such were not happening.
It strikes me almost like people trying to fill out business expenses forms. You know, the old story, well, is the hat that you had to buy for the business trip an allowable expense because you needed a hat and you were on business and you lost your hat? That similar type of item might have gotten into OCOs. Not hats,
No, absolutely. I mean, it's gotten more and more difficult to disaggregate. We wrote a report nearly 10 years ago warning about this. And suggested that DOD work with the Office of Management and Budget and provide some guidance for the proper uses of Overseas Contingency Operations funding. And they did that. They actually published guidance in 2010, but it hasn't been updated. I mean, ideally, you want to fund and I accept what you say about the difficulty of separating it out, but you want to fund long-term predictable costs out of your regular budget. I mean, you wouldn't want – and in your home, you wouldn't want to pay your car payment or your mortgage – you know, on a credit card or, you know, out of a side job. Those are predictable long-term expenses.
We're speaking with John Pendleton, Director of Defense Capabilities at the Government Accountability Office, because the Defense Department has very well-developed processes for figuring out what should be proper costs from contractors and building weapons. But it seems like this is something where their methodology just falls short, or is it something they just need to update?
Well, I think it would be helpful to have guidance, because when we began this review, you know, we like to look at what the rules are. But in this case, the rules from 2010 didn't contemplate some of the things we're doing now. For example, there's nothing in there about the European Reassurance Initiative, a deterrence operation in Europe. And so we feel like you need the controls associated with having guidance in order to be able to, provide oversight of the program.
What about China and activities that might take place in the South China Sea, which is maybe, I don't know, programmatically equivalent to the European Reassurance Initiative, where maybe we're reassuring some of the allies in South Asia? Has that come up at all yet?
Yeah, to my knowledge, that is not a specific line item. I have to go back and look for sure. I'm pretty sure it's not. But again, that's a really good illustration of the way that this gets blended. For example, the equipment that has been worn out, particularly ground equipment, in these operations is typically being reconditioned, reset, they call it, using overseas contingency operations funds. And so that OCO money might be critical to allow the equipment to be available to go and do something in the South China Sea. And, I mean, Navy and everyone, you know, got OCO money to cover the costs associated with the wear and tear from the equipment. So that's in part why it gets so complicated. The department's done modernization with overseas contingency operations funds, and it's getting really, really hard to take apart, as I said.
So what are your recommendations? Are they mainly for the Defense Department or for Congress to help clarify all of this, or for all the parties involved?
What's it, you know, we are where we are. I mean, we have $30 billion or so in the OCO request that we would need, like I said, even if the wars weren't going on. And but we don't have a precise estimate of that. And so one of our recommendations was the Department of Defense that they get a precise estimate of what's the enduring cost being funded with OCO, because you need to know that before you can even begin to transition off it, because now they're talking about round figures. The other thing we recommended, you might imagine, is we recommended that the Office of Management and Budget update the guidance for the use of OCO, because it's really hard to provide oversight and virtually impossible to audit the appropriateness of the use given the outdated criteria.
And at this point, as we speak, there is still not a confirmed director of the Office of Management and Budget, but it sounds like this is something that, when there is one, that the Trump administration is going to have to figure out.
Absolutely. The nominee has made a number of statements that in the past that he feels that OCO has been used as a slush fund and other things. So should he continue along that line, the department is and the administration is going to need to figure out how to cover $30 billion, possibly more, of enduring costs.
And we still have the budget agreements in place, which Congress has not removed yet.
No, that's absolutely right, Tom. And I think that's the most important thing about this at this point. Anytime we've said to the department, including this report, that we think they need better controls over the use of the funds or better plans to transition the cost back into the base budget, they've typically agreed with us, that is the Department of Defense, but said that they can't fit these costs within the budget caps, and that they need relief for the budget caps from the budget caps in order to be able to do that. And presumably, if you pushed these enduring costs into the base budget, it would require a deep cut somewhere else, because these are things overseas contingency operations funds are used to fund a special operations command, other things. These are costs we are likely to pay.
John Pendleton is Director of Defense Capabilities at the Government Accountability Office. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
You can find a link to his report on the OCO and to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
Agency managers will often tell you how budget sequestration has made it harder for them to fulfill their missions. Well, now there's evidence the Budget Control Act has put life in danger. One analyst says that seems to be the case for the Marine Corps aviators. They've experienced a spike in training accidents. Amy Schaefer, a research associate at the Center for a New American Security, tells Federal News Radio's Eric White how budget constraints affect Marine pilots.
One of the things that we've seen with the sequester is a decline in aviation budgets across all four services, but the Marines in particular have seen an immense spike in accidents that is really concerning. And so that sort of sparked my interest in looking into how this was affected.
Any numbers you can give me on the increase in the amount of aviation accidents that you said that there's a spike in there?
Absolutely. So in September of 2015, Marine Corps aviation fatalities actually reached a five-year high. They had 18 fatalities. And then only a few months later, in January of 2016, there was another crash that killed another 12 Marines.
So accidents are terrible. Is there a normal level of accidents that comes? Because, you know, obviously it's a dangerous game that they're playing there, but what is the normal amount, I guess, of accidents that you would usually see?
Right. So there's no question about it. Aviation is a dangerous business, but we did see a spike. We are seeing an abnormal high in the fact that we had 18 over the course of 2015.
And what role does sequestration play in that?
So what happened with the sequester is we saw the budget cuts happen overall, and this means that you're cutting flight hours, you're cutting the maintenance depot. So it's had a real snowball effect. There's less money for flight hours, less money for training, and now we're seeing a backlog where the Marine Corps just doesn't have enough of what they call ready basic aircraft for people to be trained on. So the production lines slowed down for all of these different aircraft, so they don't have the spare parts that they need, and maintainers had to be let go. So the maintenance depots have a backlog and they're not staffed the way that they should be. And then all of this has the effect of all of the resources having to go to the aviators and the planes that are currently deployed or right about to deploy, which is certainly as it should be. But it means that those who are back at home and training and first learning to fly the aircraft don't have the aircraft they need and don't have the flight hours they need. And these are complicated planes. So that really sets up a dangerous situation for the aviators that we're trying to keep proficient and trying to keep trained. And almost all of the accidents that we've seen have been involved with training.
We're speaking with Amy Schaefer. She's a research assistant at the Center for a New American Security. So is it a big sign of ignorance that a lot of us who aren't well-versed in this subject like yourself seem to think like, oh, well, the planes are already, you know, made, that's fine, we'll just leave them there. Or, oh, these pilots are already trained, they don't need to, you know, sharpen their skills or anything. They'll be ready to go whenever we need them.
I certainly wouldn't say that it's a sign of ignorance, but with something like aviation, you do really have to maintain a training regimen in order to keep your proficiency. There's a certain minimum number of hours you're supposed to be getting every month, and we're seeing a lot of people in training who aren't getting those hours. And we put a lot of wear and tear on these planes over the past 15 years, so we are seeing them age sort of prematurely. And the initial plan for the F-18, they were supposed to be retired at about 8,000 hours, but we're pushing them well past that and trying to make modifications because of the toll all of the repeated deployments of the Marine Corps have taken on the airframes.
Are there any single stories of a plane that you've seen gone well above the 8,000 hours that you just mentioned?
I don't think there's any single story that necessarily sticks out, but unfortunately what we've seen is that with Congress's unwillingness to repeal the sequester, or even frankly pass a defense budget, we're not able to sort of fix the airframes that are showing the most amounts of stress. So what we've seen is a continuing resolution out of Congress, and that doesn't really do much to help this crisis. The Marines were hoping to have aviation readiness back as it should be by 2020, but this was a projection that counted on having a consistent budget from Congress and the ability to plan ahead in order to take care of all of these sort of maintenance depot backlogs and have the number of spare parts that they need. So what we're seeing now is the continuing resolution prevents them really from planning ahead the way they need to.
And for training, how much of a reduction in training has there been since the sequestration took place? Has it been, you know, is it drastically, is it like half the flight hours that they usually do or something like that? Or
so this is going to vary from squadron to squadron. And what we're seeing is General Davis, who's the commandant for aviation, has said that those who are deployed and those who are next ready to deploy are hitting the hours that they need. But there's really no guarantee that any of the other squadrons are going to be hitting what we would consider sort of the minimum training hours that they're supposed to have.
And so is more money really just the overall answer that, you know, there's no silver bullet or anything like that? Or can we reduce our capabilities to standards where we can afford to actually have fully trained pilots and fully capable aircrafts?
Right. So there are a couple of solutions here. And unfortunately, all of them seem to be untenable with the current political situation, which is that we either need to use the Marine Corps less so that they have the ability to sort of take stock of everything and really focus on rebuilding their readiness, or we need to ensure that they have a fully funded budget that they can plan ahead for the next 3, 4, 5 years even, and try and dig themselves out of this hole that the sequester created.
We're speaking with Amy Schaefer, research assistant at the Center for New American Security. So I imagine you're not the only organization that took a notice to the spike in aviation accidents. Has DOD's Inspector General or anybody else said anything or came out with any sort of reports damning, you know, Congress's lack of funding towards these programs?
I'm certainly not the only one to take notice. This is actually something that Marine Corps leadership has been testifying to in front of Congress for the past couple of years, with General Neller citing aviation readiness as a huge concern for him. And then we've also seen that the DOD Inspector General is actually going to be investigating towards the end of 2017 whether, with the current number of planes and the current training hours, the Marine Corps aviation, whether it can even meet its minimum standards for training and proficiency, which is really concerning, because while we may have those who are deployed and about to deploy ready to go and meeting those minimum standards, if there's any sort of contingency and those who are back home in training have to be deployed, we're going to deploy people who aren't properly trained necessarily.
And I mean, this may be an obvious answer, but, you know, what effect does that have on morale or, you know, looking to recruit more aviators for the Marines? Is that having an effect? Has anybody mentioned anything about that from the leadership?
I don't know that we've necessarily seen any direct correlation to recruiting, but I certainly don't think it's a good thing when we have news stories about these various aviation crashes coming 1 month, every 2 months. And I think that that does maybe have an effect on what people think.
Just how big is the political situation in Congress to blame for this?
You know, I think it's one of those situations where Congress knows how damaging the sequester has been, but Marine Corps aviation is sort of serving as the canary in the coal mine, and we really need to pay attention because this does have a body count.
And I know that this specifically went towards the Marine aviation, but I imagine other branches are having similar issues with sequestration in place like that.
Absolutely. The other services are having issues, and specifically across the aviation community, all four services have been telling Congress that readiness is being eroded and this is a problem. And aviation is a dangerous business.
And it's one of the more expensive programs with the military. I mean, is the amount of funding that it requires and the different areas that there are and so many moving parts, is that making it difficult as well? Because maybe budget makers are saying, oh, well, this doesn't seem like it's that important or anything like that.
You know, these are $100 million aircraft. It's going to take a certain amount of funding to keep them safe and to keep them up to date. And I think that we have a commitment to the men and women who choose to serve in the armed forces to do right by them in that way.
Amy Schaefer is a research associate for the Center for a New American Security, speaking with Federal News Radio's Eric White. Find a link to her article and share this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.